following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. In the Metro Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. Now here's Pastor Alan.
What kind of person does God look for to work through? And here's the second question. Could you be that kind of person? Don't discount that idea too quickly, okay? Some of you may be saying, there's no way. You know, I'm just ordinary me. No way God can work through me. Well, let me remind you that God's criteria for success doesn't always match up to our conventional wisdom. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul wrote to the church at Corinth, and he said this, "For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. He has chosen the weak things of the world to shame that which is strong. And the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, so that he can nullify the things that are, that no man could boast before God." In other words, God doesn't look at resumes the same way you and I do, okay? And one of the people that God worked through most prominently in the Old Testament was King David of Israel. Chuck Swindoll claims there are more chapters in the Old Testament devoted to King David than any other figure. Now, I haven't checked his math, and far be it from me to go against somebody of Brother Swindoll's stature, but I think Moses could probably give David a run for his money. But be as it may, it's pretty hard to deny that David cast a long shadow throughout the Old Testament story. David came from relative obscurity to become arguably the greatest king ancient Israel ever had. He reigned during a golden expansion era about 3,000 years ago in ancient Israel. And the quality that's most often attributed to David for his success is not his talent, it's not his tactical genius, although he had both of those in spades. Rather, he is often described as a man after God's own heart. Now, what does that even mean? A man after God's own heart. And if anything, can people like us, what can we do to approximate the kind of intimate relationship David had with God that contributed to his being able to be used by God in such powerful ways? Well, one way to understand what it means to be a person after God's own heart is to look at someone who was not, which is what we're going to do today. And in the Bible, we're introduced to this phrase, a man after God's own heart, even before we're introduced to David. We find it in 1 Samuel chapter 13. If you'll join me looking down at verse 13. Samuel said to Saul, "You have acted foolishly. You've not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." Saul was Israel's first king, David's immediate predecessor. Now, up to Saul, Israel had survived without a king ever since Joshua had led them to invade and conquer the land of Canaan some 300 years before. And in that intervening three centuries, Israel had existed in this loose confederation of tribes that were governed by their individual tribal leaders. But in times of national emergency, the Bible tells us, God would raise up a figure, a temporary leader known as a judge, who would unite the people together and lead them to victory. And the prophet Samuel is generally considered the last of those judges. And at the insistence of the people, Samuel anointed Saul to be Israel's first king. According to 1 Samuel chapter 8, the tribal leaders approached Samuel and they said, "Behold, you have grown old and your sons do not walk in your ways. So appoint a king for us to judge us like all the other nations have. Samuel, you're about to pass off the scene. We need some new leadership. We don't trust your boys. So give us a king." All the other nations have kings. Now, of course, that's a great reason to have something, right? Because everybody else does. Yeah. And it worked out for Israel just about the same way it usually works out for us. At first, Samuel resisted. It's like, you guys do not need a king. And they kept insisting. And finally, God told Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you. For they've not rejected you, they've rejected me. Before embarking to find them a king, Samuel warned the people that about what having a king would mean. Instead of a temporary judge who would lead by charisma and influence, the king would be a permanent presence who would rule by authority and law. In submitting to a king, the people would trade some of their liberty for a little bit of security. The king would place demands on the people. We read about some of those in 1 Samuel 8, verses 10 through 17. He reminded them that the king would draft their sons to serve in his army. He would draft their daughters to work in his palace. He would draft the best of their servants to work in his fields and in his building projects. He would tax their produce to support his own household and his royal agenda. So having a king might not be all it's cracked up to be. But even after Samuel spelled out all of those negatives, the people insisted on having a king. And so Samuel and God gave them a king. They gave them Saul. Saul possessed all the outward qualities of a winner. Okay? He had a great resume. He had the appearance of a champion. In 1 Samuel 9, verses 1 and 2, we're introduced to him, and he's described in terms of his pedigree and his appearance. Now, there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Becheroth, the son of Aphiah, the son of a Benjamite, a mighty man of valor. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a choice and handsome man. And there was not a more handsome person than he among all the sons of Israel. From his shoulders up, he was taller than all the people. I can tell this because Tom's not here for me to embarrass, but a few weeks ago, of course, Bill Mason was filling in for me while I was on vacation. And Bill's kind of a tall guy. I think he's like 6'1", 6'2". And I texted him after I got back in town and said, hey, how'd it go? And he said, well, went well, but it's not often I'm intimidated. Because that day I'd had Brother Tom fill in to do the welcome and the announcements that day. So Saul was like Tom, head and shoulders above everybody else. He was a good-looking guy. People were drawn to him. His appearance is stressed again the first time he's introduced to the tribal chiefs in Israel in 1 Samuel chapter 10. So they ran and took him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders up. Samuel said to all the people, do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? Surely there's no one like him among all the people. Man, isn't he a fine specimen of a man? He looks like a king. As far as the people were concerned, that was all that was important. So he had the appearance of a champion. He also had the approval of the crowd. When Samuel presented Saul to the tribal chiefs there in Israel, in the passage we just read, we're told to all the people shouted and said, long live the king. Not too long afterwards, an Israelite town was threatened by Ammonite raiders. And so the men of that city sent messengers to Saul. It's kind of like, okay, Brother King, it's time to put up or shut up. We need some help. And so Saul, we're told, the Spirit of God came upon him mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry. So he took a yoke of oxen, and he cut them in pieces. And he sent them throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of messengers, saying, whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so it shall be done to their oxen. That's a great way to win friends and influence people, isn't it? Then the dread of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out as one man. He numbered them in Bezek, and the sons of Israel were 300,000, and the men of Judah, 30,000. So in short order, Saul was able to rally the nation together and liberate the besieged city. And at the assembly of the tribal elders, Saul had become king in theory, but at the battle of Jabesh, he became king in fact. And for the rest of his life, which most scholars estimate to be, he reigned about 40, 42 years, the majority of the Israelites submitted to Saul's rule. Not only did he have the appearance of a champion, not only have the approval of the people, he also had the anointing of his creator. The Lord is the one who directed Samuel to Saul in the first place. In 1 Samuel chapter 9, starting at verse 15, "Now a day before Saul's coming, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel, saying, 'About this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be prince over my people, Israel. He will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines. For I have regarded my people because their cry has come to me.' And when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, 'Behold, the man of whom I spoke to you, this one shall rule over my people.'" In 1 Samuel 10, verse 1, we read, "Then Samuel took the flask of oil, poured it on Saul's head, and kissed him and said, 'Has not the Lord anointed you as ruler over his inheritance?'" In directing Samuel to anoint Saul, God was giving the people the kind of man they thought they wanted as a king. That should serve as a warning to us. Just because God allows you to have something doesn't necessarily mean it's what's best for you. Sometimes God allows us to have what we think we want to show us what we really need. By every outward measure, Saul was set up for success. Nevertheless, Saul failed at fulfilling his God-given purpose. And that brings us to the chapters that we're looking at this morning. Though Saul possessed a lot of outward advantages, it didn't take long for him to reveal that he had many inner flaws. First of all, he was vain. He was overly concerned about what other people thought. He was impulsive and given to rash decisions. In fact, one of the most famous incidents is recorded in 1 Samuel 14. Saul and his army had routed an army of Philistine invaders. And in order to press the advantage, Saul had ordered, and this is my paraphrase, "Nobody eats until all the Philistines are dead, on penalty of death." You can read about that in 1 Samuel 14:24. Now, the men who had been fighting and chasing down Philistines all day refused to eat. And they were starting to get a little fatigued, a little hungry. They were flagging a little bit. Saul's son and right-hand man, Jonathan, who had been out conducting a secret mission, didn't get the memo. So he's rejoining the rest of the army here, and he is chasing Philistines with the rest of them. And he is hungry, and he comes across a honeycomb that's dripping with honey. And he says, "Hey, I need a pick-me-up." So he scooped up some of that honey, and some of the men said, "Didn't you hear what the order was? No one eats until all the Philistines are dead." Jonathan's like, "Well, who came up with a stupid idea like that?" Your dad? So after the battle, Saul found that his rash order had put him in a bit of a pickle because his own son had violated the order, and everybody knew it. So what's he going to do? The troops also recognized that a big part of their victory had come at the hands of Jonathan, as if they needed an added level of difficulty in this matter. If the troops had not intervened on Jonathan's behalf, Saul would have been forced to execute his own son over a stupid, rash order that didn't make any sense. But that's the kind of man that Saul was. He was impulsive. As he got older, he was given to bouts of depression, even homicidal rage. His personality became fickle and unpredictable. One minute, he might be treating an underling as his favorite. The next minute, he's trying to stick the guy to the wall with a spear. Some of y'all ever work for a guy like that, somebody like that? You know? Yeah, I've known people like that in my life. You never know which boss is going to show up that day, and it's the same person. The fate of Saul's reign was sealed by two bad decisions which showed what he really thought about the God who had put him in power. According to 1 Samuel 13, this passage we read at the beginning, earlier in his campaign against the Philistines, Saul violated instructions given to him by God's prophet Samuel. The Philistines had established a garrison in a town called Geba, which is a town that actually belonged to Israel. It was on Israeli territory. And so Saul called together a force of about 3,000 men. Surely that'd be enough to take care of this problem. He kept 2,000 for himself. He assigned another 1,000 under Jonathan's command and had them camp out down the road. He was at a place called Michmash. Jonathan was stationed a few miles away with his troops. And then Jonathan's forces actually attacked and dispatched the Philistine garrison at Geba. Wiped them out. And so Saul says, "That'll send a message to those Philistines." Sure did. Because next thing you know, the Philistines show up with a massive army, 30,000 chariots, 6,000 cavalry. Infantry, we're told, like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance. This massive army was marching toward Michmash. Now, earlier, a few days earlier, Samuel had told Saul, hey, listen, after Jonathan's force has launched their attack, you withdraw to this other place and you wait 7 days, okay? To consolidate your forces, wait for me 7 days, and then we'll take care of this Philistine problem. So if Saul had not listened to Samuel, he probably would have been trapped in Michmash and wiped out. But he'd withdrawn. The Philistines occupied Michmash with this huge army. But the massive show of force by the Philistines began to play a real number on Israelite morale. And some of Saul's soldiers began to desert. People began to slip out, head for the exits. Saul figured out, you know, if I don't counterattack soon, I may not have much of an army to counterattack with. However, these troops are going to refuse to move out until we offer the traditional sacrifices. When they go out, they want to know God's on their side, right? So we got to wait to do these sacrifices. Well, they waited 4 days, 5 days, 6 days, 7 days. No Samuel. Samuel's the guy supposed to offer the sacrifices. He's the priest. He's the prophet. So what does Saul do? On the seventh day, no Samuel. Saul says, you know what? This is ridiculous. Bring me those animals. We're going to have us a sacrifice, and then we're going to attack the Philistines. He had no sooner offered that sacrifice, and guess who shows up? Here comes Samuel, walking into camp. And he says, what have you done? Now, his sin was not that the king offered sacrifices, because there are occasions where the king was the one who was allowed to offer the sacrifices. His sin was he did not wait as he had been instructed to. He violated God's command. And when challenged on that, Saul blamed everybody but himself. He blamed the Philistines. He blamed his own people. He blamed Samuel. Where were you, Brother Samuel? And it was at this point that Samuel informed him that his impatience had cost him any hope of a dynasty. Again, in verse 13, Samuel said to Saul, you have acted foolishly. You've not kept the commandment of the Lord your God. Verse 14, now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord's appointed him ruler over his people. Now some years later, Saul would make a similar mistake. God sent word through Samuel to Saul, commanding him to execute divine judgment on a people known as the Amalekites. The Amalekites had been a thorn in Israel's side for over 300 years, ever since they were wandering around in the wilderness under Moses. So God says, it's time to take care of these people once and for all. Wipe them out. Don't leave anyone alive. Do not take any spoils. Okay? It's a practice known as harem, holy war in Israelite tradition. And so Saul was to wipe out the entire, as if the Amalekites had never existed. Now after the battle, Samuel arrives at the camp to find that Saul's troops had not exactly followed orders. They had taken captives from among the Amalekites. There were slaves. The king of Amalek was still alive and a prisoner. There were animals, livestock, that these soldiers had taken as spoil. Saul tried to pass it off and say, well, we were going to offer a big sacrifice, so we kept the good stuff to offer to God. As if that makes it okay, right? Samuel again delivers the divine verdict against Saul in 1 Samuel 15, verses 26 and 28. I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. In verse 28, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. His story should serve as a cautionary tale of wasted potential. He could have been a contender, but he threw it all away. See, God perfects his plan through imperfect people who are inclined to honor his word. Centuries later, the Apostle Paul would stand before a Jewish synagogue in central Turkey, and he would remind them in Acts 13, 22, after he removed Saul, God raised up David to be their king, concerning whom he also testified and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who will do all my will. So what's the major difference between David and between Saul? Why is one described as a man after God's own heart, and the other was not? Well, the key is found in Samuel's verdict against Saul. Going back to 1 Samuel 13, you have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God. You have not kept what the Lord commanded you. 1 Samuel 15, 26, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you. Both Saul and David were flawed men. They were both prone to mistakes. David made some doozies during his reign. We're going to learn about those in the next few weeks. The difference was David's heart was inclined towards God, while Saul's was not. Saul wanted God's blessings, but he didn't really want God. David, on the other hand, wanted to know God personally. Psalm 42, verse 1, which is attributed to David by most scholars, he writes this, as the deer pants for the water brooks, so my soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. Does your soul thirst for God? In Psalm 27, verses 13 and 14, I would have despaired unless I believed I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Yes, wait for the Lord. That was David. What was it that got Saul in trouble? He had a problem with waiting for the Lord, right? Saul was only interested in building his own kingdom, while David was focused on extending God's kingdom. When Saul sinned, what did he do? He blamed everybody else. He made excuses. When David sinned, as we're going to see, he took responsibility and he repented. Back in 1978, Muhammad Ali, the great boxing champion, visited the United Nations to campaign against racial injustice. And during a press conference, and you can go look this up on YouTube, there are several copies of this video floating around. But he said something very striking. Quote, the personality of a person, the ways of a person, the thoughts, the deeds, and the actions, it's all based around the heart. For what is a man? A man is his heart. What an insight. A man is his heart. Which way is your heart leaning today? Is it leaning towards God or is it leaning away from Him? Do you really want to use God only when it's convenient? Kind of keep Him around as your good luck charm? Or do you really want to know God intimately and passionately, to bow before Him and give Him the weight in your life that He deserves? If you really want to be the kind of person that God can use, make sure your heart is aligned with His.
This program is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church. Music courtesy of Jason Shaw at audionautix.com. If you enjoy this program, we would love to hear from you. Email us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thank you for listening.